All right. Well, we are so excited to be able to celebrate this day with all of you. Thank you for being here. And I just want you to know that there are so many people all across the United States that are praying for this church and the work of this church every single week. There are communities all over the U.S. that are thinking about us, that are watching what we're doing, and you all play such a huge and important role in the process of beginning this church. And so we're really, really grateful that you guys are here today. We get to celebrate our one-year anniversary. And I was thinking that the least significant birthday in the human life is like your first birthday. We have two young children, and so we have celebrated young one-year-old birthdays, and the kids don't even really know what's going on. And we're mainly the ones celebrating, getting things ready, buying the cake, and making it festive. But the kids don't really know. But I think that the opposite may be true in the life of a church. And the first year is like the greatest day to celebrate in this early season. And so we're so excited to be able to do that. But I did want to take a moment to pause and to recognize a few people who have really made a unique impact in the life of the church. And that is our leadership team. We have a group of people that are amongst you here today that serve so faithfully every single week. They give up their lunch every single week. They do everything they can within their power to make sure that what we're doing here on a weekend experience is getting better, that it's becoming more meaningful and more important. So I just want to give a round of applause to our leadership team. Shirley, thank you so much for all you do. Paul, Kayla, Tarun, Brandon, Brian, Sharon, Premu, Tony, you guys are just some rock stars that serve behind the scenes. Nobody ever knows what you're doing, but you guys are contributing to the work, and you've been doing that for so long, and it means so much. I also want to thank our volunteer team. Without your help every single Sunday, these things wouldn't go up. We wouldn't have TVs or chairs. We wouldn't have music. We wouldn't have coffee, most importantly, without our team. And so they serve so faithfully. They mean so much to the life of this organization. I want to show them some love this morning, because they have done so, so much. When we first began the thought, when we started walking down the journey of planting a church, we started doing a little bit of research, and we talked to as many people as we could that knew about the process of church planting. And finally, we started connecting with people who were local to the San Francisco Bay Area. And one of the people told me, they said, the San Francisco Bay Area is a graveyard for church planting. And what they mean is that a lot of churches in this area find it difficult to ever reach that point of momentum where they can become this self-sustaining entity, and so they end up having to close their doors after a short amount of time. I've even heard some research that suggests that the San Francisco Bay Area is the most difficult place in the United States to start and launch a healthy, thriving church. But despite the history of this area, we have witnessed God doing so many amazing things in this community. Over the last year, we have seen 22 people make the life-changing decision to become a follower of Jesus Christ. That is so exciting. 22 people. In the last year, we have seen three people make that really bold decision to go public with their faith in Jesus Christ through believers' baptism. They wanted everyone to know that they were now identified as a follower of Jesus. I'm so thankful that we've been able to see God sort of make these life-changing internal transformations in people's lives, but we've also been able to really serve and impact the community around us. Every single employee that works at Castlemont Elementary has received some kind of benefit as a result of our church and your generosity. We've been able to serve this school in a number of different ways, and that's been a really powerful witness in the community. We've also, a few months ago, had the opportunity to pass out 150 Christmas trees to our local neighbors here through Castlemont Elementary and then one of the other elementary schools nearby. We've been able to serve our community, and I can think of like a number of different stories that we could tell about all that God is doing through this community. There are people in our church that have never been a part of church before we started Eden. There are people who are serving in leadership at our church who have never served in leadership at a church before. There are people volunteering, showing up, and sacrificing for the work that is done here that have never, ever done that before in the context of a local church. And to me, that is such a powerful testimony about what God is doing, that he is drawing people to himself and he is furthering this work that we're doing here at Eden and in this community. And so I am so thankful that we have such a testimony to talk about over the course of this past year. But what I love about celebrations like this is that to me, these are opportunities to talk and to think and to really celebrate what we are leaning into as much as what we have gone through. It's as much about looking forward, in my opinion, as it is about looking back. And so today I want to begin our conversation by asking if you have experienced this thought. Have you guys ever asked yourself the question, what if? Like, what if I got the job that I've been hoping to have for a long time? Or what if I got into the school that I've been applying to get into? Or what if I got the raise that I've been praying for the last 6 months? Or what if I found love for the first time this year, true love? What would that do to my life? What if I entered into a brand new career that I've been working toward for a long time? I love asking the question, what if? What if? And I don't know if that speaks into the fact that I like to dream about a lot of things or envision a lot of things, but I love that question because what I feel like it does is it begins to initiate and ignite the imagination, and you begin to dream about what is possible. What is potential? What is possible? What your life could be used for in this context? And so today, we're going to begin asking that question with regard to the future of Eden Church. And I want to take a little bit of time to dream with you this morning about what our church will look like. And we're going to look back to a passage that has been so foundational to the way that we operate as a church. And so we're going to be looking this morning at the New Testament, which is the second half of the Bible. And we're going to be reading out of one of the four biographies of Jesus' life. And it was written by a man named Luke. It is also known as the Gospel of Luke. And we're going to be picking up at a point in Jesus' ministry where it's really beginning to gain traction. And people from all over the region are coming to hear Jesus teach. They were impressed. They were drawn to his teaching. And his influence is beginning to grow. And what you realize is that as Jesus' influence begins to grow, so does the opposition. Last week, we said that oftentimes the level of resistance that you're experiencing in life is equal to the amount of progress that you're trying to make. The level of resistance you're experiencing in life is equal to the amount of progress that you're trying to make. And when we look at Jesus' ministry, we see that in many ways, Jesus was turning his culture upside down. His teachings were sort of undermining this system of oppression among people's lives, and he was giving them a way to experience freedom that they had never experienced before. And the people that he was receiving opposition from were those who were beginning to lose some of their power and some of the authority in their culture. And so today we're going to read a passage about how Jesus responds to some of the opposition in his life. And so let's go ahead and look in Luke chapter 15. You have your Bibles, you can pull them out. If you don't have a Bible, we typically have Bibles at our guest center outside the front door, and they are completely free, so you can have them and give them away and take them with you. Or an option that I love is you can download the YouVersion Bible app, and on that app, you have access to so many awesome translations. And if you have neither of those this morning, you don't have to worry at all, because we will have every sentence that we're reading from the Bible up on the screen. So let's begin reading. Luke chapter 15, verse 1 and 2. It says, "Tax collectors and other notorious sinners often came to listen to Jesus teach. And this made the Pharisees and the teachers of the religious law complain that he was associating with such sinful people, even eating with them." I love how Luke will always sort of set the context before he takes you where he wants you to go. And basically the way he sets up the context here is he gives us this phrase, he uses the terms, he calls them tax collectors and other notorious sinners. And this really was a way for Luke to describe some of the most despised people in the first century Jewish context. Tax collectors were often viewed as traitors of the culture. Nobody liked tax collectors because what they would do is they would steal from their own people and they would give the money to the government that was oppressing their people. And so people often viewed them as traitors. And then Luke sort of just describes these other notorious sinners. So these were people who were sort of famous for their evil deeds. They were famous for their negative deeds and their negative contribution to the world. And these people that nobody wanted around were for some reason drawn to Jesus' teachings. People who were sort of devalued, or maybe the culture had said there really is no room for them, there is no grace for them. Jesus, for some reason, was drawing these people to him. And the wonderful thing is that Jesus loved to spend time with them. But this puzzled the Pharisees, because the Pharisees were sort of those status-driven people. They loved status. They were the type of people, the type of friends that you have that love to let you know that they knew important people. And I'm kind of like that. And I would probably be name-dropping a lot of people on Sunday morning if I knew any famous people. And this is how I know. This is how I know I'm of that cut of cloth, is because my wife and I were at the new Ike's at Santana Row this past weekend, and the guy who was working there told us that Marshawn Lynch was going to be there on Friday. And so, just FYI, if you guys are Marshawn Lynch fan, I can't verify whether or not that's true. That's just the information I have available to me right now. But the first thing I thought was, how cool would it be if, like, I had Marshawn Lynch next to me, And he was like inviting people to eat in church for me. That is like a form of name dropping, right? You want to seem important and significant and popular simply by association, but by no means of what you've accomplished on your own. This was sort of the mindset of the Pharisees, and that is the exact reason they were criticizing Jesus, because they were evaluating his own capacity based on the people that he was ministering to. And so they were making fun of him. They were mocking him. They were like, look at who Jesus' congregation is. Look at who Jesus' church. Look at his followers. They're the worst scum of our society. Who cares? And so this was like their form of mocking Jesus. Because in their mind, they wanted to be associated with important people or people who others valued. And so they begin to mock him. And they were judging Jesus because these were people who were part of his church, but they weren't only criticizing Jesus because of the people who were part of his ministry, but they were also criticizing Jesus because it says that he ate with them. And in this context, that was like one of the most familial things that you could do. Like when you broke bread with someone, when you ate with them, it was your way of saying that like you are intimately connected with that person. You are in fellowship with those people. And so when Jesus did that, he was sort of taking sides. He was like, yeah, these are my people. These are the people that I want to interact with. And you don't just break bread with anyone. You break bread with probably the level of friends that you would go out on vacation with, right? Think about how many friends in your life you could actually go on vacation with. There are probably very, very few, right? You only want to go on vacation with friends that you think you'll still be friends with after vacation. And so it was important. And so Jesus kind of senses that this is part of the conversation. There are these conversations that are happening about him, about his ministry. And so this is how he responds in verse 3. It says, so Jesus told them this story. He says, if a man has 100 sheep and one of them gets lost, what will he do? Won't he leave the 99 others in the wilderness and go to search for the one that is lost until he finds it? And when he has found it, he will joyfully carry it home on his shoulders. When he arrives, he will call together his friends and neighbors, saying, rejoice with me because I have found my lost sheep. What Jesus is doing is he's using sort of this rhetorical device. It's called a parable. And Jesus would use parables to help people understand these deep spiritual truths. And the way that he would do it is he would share a story from the common everyday experience, because he knew that one of the best ways to convince someone of a truth is to help them feel it. And if they've never felt that truth before, the best way to do it then is to help them to remind them of an experience like the truth that he's trying to help them understand. And so he tells them a parable, and the point of this entire parable was to help the Pharisees see where their thinking was out of alignment with God's thinking. And so he asks the question. He says, what would you do if you had 100 sheep and one was lost? And to everyone in that conversation, the answer was obvious. You leave the 99 who are safe, who are protected, who are cared for, who are together, who are not in harm's way. You forsake the 99 and you go after the one. You go and find the one that is lost. I used to be a college pastor, and we would oftentimes take kids on trips, college students, young adults, and I know that if we went on a trip with 30 college students and we came back with 29, I was going to be in a lot of trouble. Now, you might be able to make the argument and the case that, well, I brought back almost all of them. I brought back 99% of the college kids. What's the big deal with one kid? And maybe that was a kid that nobody said, okay, we can, maybe he was left on purpose. But to somebody in his life, he was extremely valuable to them, right? To someone, they cared a lot about them. That one sheep represented so much value to the shepherd. He raised it, he fed it, he cared for it, he provided for it, he sheltered it, he loved it. And so in that scenario, the right course of action is to forsake the 99 and to do whatever it takes to find that one sheep that was alone, that was lost, that was vulnerable, that was in danger. And then we're told when he finds the sheep, he brings the sheep back and he joyfully carries that sheep on his shoulders. And we have no idea how far he would have had to travel, how many mountains he would have had to climb, how many hills he would have had to cover, how many miles he was trekking across this land to carry this sheep on his shoulder, but it says that he does it with joy. And not only does he do it with joy in the process and in the journey, but we're told that when he comes back, he invites his neighbor, he makes this like this public celebration that he has found this valuable thing and it is now safe. One of the scariest moments in my young life was when I was about 7 years old. My mom had just started going to church, and it was this small little church in downtown San Jose, and this church was doing a fundraiser, and so they rented a booth at Cinco de Mayo. And I don't, if you've ever been to Cinco de Mayo in downtown San Jose, I haven't been since, which, you know, probably speaks to the scarring nature of this event. But there are tens of thousands of people that just crowd the streets. It's a crazy, crazy event. And so my mom, this church had a booth, and they were selling barbecue, chicken and ribs and all that stuff as part of a fundraiser. And so she wanted to help and be a part of it. So she shows up, but she invited me to come along to this event only under the premise that I would be able to play my Sega Game Gear the whole time. If you remember the Sega Game Gear, I was playing Sonic the Hedgehog with Tails. And that was actually the only game that I played. I can't remember another game that I had. And so I was pretty focused on this game. But the problem of this whole situation was the location of our booth. We were so far from the nearest bathrooms, so that if I ever had to use the bathroom, we'd have to walk through crowds and crowds of people. And at 7 years old, I don't think I was paying close attention to like the location around me. And so at some point, I had to use the bathroom. I told my mom. And so we start making our way to the public bathrooms in a far distant location. And as we're walking, I'm sort of playing my game and then following my mom and sort of weaving our way through the crowd. And I'd sort of go back to my game every few seconds, make sure I'd peek up, and my mom would still be there. But at some point, I had maybe given attention to this game for too long, because when I looked up, my mom was gone. I couldn't see her. And I started to panic. I sort of ran around the general vicinity of where I thought she was. And when I couldn't see her just by gazing at the crowd, I ran across one street, and then I ran across another street, and then I ran across another street, sort of panicking and sort of flurrying. Some people said I was crying. I can't be sure of that. But that's the level of panic that was going on in my heart because I didn't remember how to get back to the booth. And so I remember I was freaked out. I saw these police officers. I thought, should I go and ask them for help? But I decided not to. I was shy in that moment. And so I started just walking around Cinco de Mayo. And it had to have been 25 or 30 minutes where I'm like completely at 7 years old, out of sight, out of mind, had no contact with any human adult. And then all of a sudden I see this little flag that was sticking up that reminded me that I remember seeing when I was at our booth. And so I knew that I was near where I was. I started walking off into the distance to this flag. And as I got closer, my mom saw me. And I remember the flood of emotions that my mom had when she saw me. She grabbed me and squeezed me so tight. I wasn't the only one crying that day. My mom had just about a heart attack. And she didn't care that she had contacted the police to help find me. She didn't care that she had sent out a dozen other people from the church to scour Cinco de Mayo trying to find this little boy with a Game Gear game. All she wanted to know was that I was safe. And when I was in her arms, she was celebrating with joy. And this is the heart of God. In verse 7, it says, in the same way, there is more joy in heaven when one lost sinner who repents and returns to God than over the 99 others who are righteous and haven't strayed away. I imagine Jesus staring into the eyes of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law as he is saying these words. There is more joy when someone finds life in Jesus than when the righteous stay righteous. There's more joy to celebrate in the kingdom when it grows wider than when it remains the same. Jesus is sort of redirecting the value systems of the Pharisees in this moment. And I think that maybe more than any other parable, maybe more than any other teaching, this teaching has really spoken into the heartbeat of who we are as a church. And in fact, we believe so much in this idea that the one is greater than the 99 that we have actually created a value around it, and we call it the one is greater than the 99. Really creative and original. And so every time someone comes into leadership at Eden Church, we talk about the one being greater than the 99. And this value in our church speaks to the priority that we give to reaching people who identify themselves as spiritually unengaged. And we are unashamed that we have prioritized reaching people who lack a relationship, a growing relationship with Jesus Christ. Because we believe that this is the heart of God. This is the passion of God. It is not about keeping good people good. It is about bringing people into the abundant life that God speaks about, that he has provided a world to engage in, that he has provided people to participate in that life with. And so what it means for us as a church is that we are committed to do whatever it takes to create safe spaces for any kind of person to find life in Jesus. This means that we are committed to hospitality. We are committed to providing that free space for people who look differently than us, for people who think differently than us, who believe differently than us. Believe it or not, for people who vote differently than us. Right? This is not a country club. We are not here trying to be around people who are in the same socioeconomic class, who are the same race class, who are in the same season of life. We are not trying to all look and talk and think the same way, but we are centered around a truth, and we are centered around the experience that our lives have been changed by the power of Jesus. And that relationship, that is where we are united. And so we'll do whatever it takes to remove barriers. We'll do whatever it takes to make sure that you don't have to show up to church with a systematic theology book to understand what we're talking about. We will conform our language. We'll do whatever it takes. If there's one person in our world and in our community that longs to have a relationship with God but has not been encountered by a community that loves them and wants to invite them into that relationship, then we're going to do whatever it takes to be that community. Because it's in that relationship where life transformation takes place. And we want to be that kind of church where people's lives are actually being transformed because of what we do on a Sunday morning and because of what we do throughout the week and the way that we love each other in community and the way that we serve people. We want people to walk out of this experience having walked away just a little bit different than when they came in. Think about how crazy it is to be standing here this morning when 3 years ago this was just a dream that was so undefined. The idea of starting a brand new church, a brand new community of faith, believing that maybe, just maybe, God could use us to do something significant for His kingdom. I feel like as we dream about who we want to be as a church, I pray that someday people will talk about how Eden Church was a community of people that even though they didn't agree, I didn't agree with them when I walked in the room, they loved me so well, they respected me, they were so kind that they invited me into this space, and through that process, I found life in Jesus. I pray that someday we will have some of the kids that right now are learning about how much Jesus loves them and cares for them, that someday they will come back when they're adults and they'll say, Pastor Daniel, and maybe someone will call me Pastor Daniel. I don't know. You guys don't have to. But they'll say, Pastor Daniel, I just got back from serving a semester overseas with one of the most unreached, remote people groups in the entire world, and they never heard about the name of Jesus until our group went in. And I remember all of my teachers, my Sunday school teachers and Eden kids reminding me over and over, telling me all these stories about how God loves me. And finally, there was a moment in my life where I embraced that love and it radically transformed the way that I see the world around me. And I felt compelled to go to the furthest, most remotest parts of the world to share that same message with people who have never heard. I pray that if our church was ever removed from this community, they would fill a void. I pray that we would be the type of church, I dream that we would be the type of church where every single person is engaged, where we are all on this journey taking one step of faith after another, one step of hard, bold, courageous faith after another, believing that God will use our faithfulness to impact the lives of the world around us. But I think it'll only happen if a few things happen. Planting a church, growing a church, serving a community is really hard, hard work. It is rewarding work. It is the most rewarding work, but it is hard work. I went, when we first started even dreaming about starting a church, we went to this conference where this guy was the keynote speaker, and I'd been watching his ministry in an underserved area, and I just loved what I saw him doing, and it was a really powerful thing. And so I was really excited to go to this conference because the title of his message was called The Secret Sauce. And I said, oh, I need the secret sauce. I need to know what it takes to start. And it was all about starting churches. And so I thought, oh, yes, I'm going to this conference. I drove hours to get there. I show up to this conference, and I'm like ready to go. This was like in a season where I was learning to take notes, so I was leaning forward in my seat. It finally comes up, the keynote speaker, the guy I've been watching, I see him in person for the first time, and he begins this message that he calls the secret sauce. And over time, he begins to like unfold. He says, do you guys want to know what the secret sauce is? And we're like, heck yeah, we want to know what the secret sauce is. And so he goes, okay, I'm going to tell you what the secret sauce is. And he goes back. And he comes back out, and he has this clear bucket, and on the front of the bucket, it says, the secret sauce. And so we were all, like, drooling. And then he sort of allows for the crowd to quiet down, and he begins to pull these strips of paper out. On the first strip of paper, it says blood. And he pulls out the second strip. On the second strip, it says sweat. Places on the table, pulls out the third strip. On that final strip of paper, it says tears. He says, if you want to know the secret sauce of starting anything significant in your life, that is the secret sauce. Blood, sweat, and tears. That is what it takes to make a difference. And the beautiful part about being a part of this community of faith is that we get to give our blood and our sweat and our tears to the most significant thing in the world. We get to offer the world something that comes from no other source. And that is a relationship with God that changes us from the inside out. The second thing it's going to take is faith. I love that we have a faith-filled church. And a few weeks ago, we had the opportunity to baptize two women. And someone stood there that day and they recorded the baptism, and you may have seen it on Facebook or social media. But I don't know how many, I can't count how many times I watched that video. I can't count how many times in my heart I just celebrated that God was moving in our community. And some people say only two people. And I'll say those are two people that if we didn't come, may have never connected with God. And I watched those videos over and over again, and I begin to just think about their lineage of faith, and they may not even know it. But I thought of a man named John Irwin. He was the associate pastor of an all-black Pentecostal church in downtown San Jose. And John would go around our neighborhood, and he would canvass the neighborhood, inviting people to church. And he would always make it a point to stop at our house and invite my mom. And he was always so funny and nice and kind, but it would always end the conversation. He would say, Kathleen, when are you and your boys going to come to church with me and my family? And this was at one of the most difficult seasons in our family's life. My parents had just gotten divorced. My mom was experiencing horrible types of depression. She was having involved in some addictive behaviors, and it was just a season where my mom later described to me, she said, If I didn't have children, I would have committed suicide. And we met John. He loved us. He cared for us. And at one point, my mom finally decided that we're going to go to this church. We're going to check it out because I've tried everything else and nothing seems to be satisfying the way that I need. And so we darkened the doorsteps of Bethesda Community Church in the summer of 1992. And in that moment, my mom's life was radically transformed by the gospel. And it was through that moment that my mom began to teach and to minister to my brother and I. And at one point, I gave my life to Jesus. And then God put this seed in my heart to start a church in this area. And I reached out to my friend named Rick Trevino. And I said, Rick, I don't know if you still live in the area, but we should grab coffee together. And Rick said, sure. And we had a conversation. And for some reason, Rick was open to being a part of a startup church. And that was crazy. And he showed it to all of our meetings. And then Rick started inviting a bunch of people to church. And people were coming. And some of you are here today. And then one day, Rick met a girl named Sophie at a business group, a networking group. And we had an event going on Sunday morning called the Father's Day Fest, the best Father's Day event in the history of Campbell, California. And our volunteers showed up early that morning to set up. And we had truck drivers and trailer drivers that showed up early that morning to set up. And they didn't know that just a few weeks earlier or a week earlier, Rick had sent an email to a girl named Sophie and said, you should come check out this event. And it just so happened that Sophie was from out of the area. She wasn't going to be traveling back. And she shows up to eat in church. And she comes right when it starts and she left right when it ended. She wasn't trying to talk to anybody, but she came back the next week. She showed up when it started, she left when it ended, but she came back the week after, and she showed up when it started and left when it ended, and she came back the week after, and she came back, and she came back, and she came back, and then one day she signed up for a group, all about exploring faith in Jesus. And slowly God begin to work in her heart in a powerful way. And about a month ago, Sophie made the decision to become a follower of Jesus Christ. But that is the beauty of what it means to take little steps of faith. Right? It is not any one of us that are going to transform the world, but collectively we become this force on earth that God intended to be, this unstoppable thing that could not be contained by even the worst of enemies. And that is the local church. And we're not a thing, but we are a community of people that are filled with the Spirit of God, committed to be agents of change in our world. The final thing is it's going to take every single one of us, every single one of us, to have the type of impact we want to have in our community. I love this quote by Theodore Roosevelt. It's called "The Man in the Arena." It's a portion of this message that he gives. He said, "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes up short again and again, because there is no effort without error or shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasm, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at worst, if he fails, at least he fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who never know victory or defeat." The challenge today is that every single one of us have stepped into an arena. I always say you never end up at church on accident. And so everyone today has at least taken a step to consider, to explore faith. But the challenge is, as we begin sort of this new season in the life of the church, I want to sort of offer up an opportunity, invite you to re-up on what God has already been doing in your life in this season. To step into a new arena. To be willing to go a little bit further in that commitment to Jesus than you've ever been before. And just to say, "God, I just want to see what you have for me in this space." And I think that that probably looks different for all of us. For some of us, we have walked into this church, and that is a new arena for us in this season of life. The fact that you have come here today was an act of bold and courageous faith on your part. Some of us have maybe been distant from God, or maybe we've just been out of the rhythm. Life has gotten crazy. We've sort of gotten flooded with other responsibilities, and we've just sort of lost our focus for a little bit. Maybe today is the day that God is saying, "Let's step into a new arena. Let's get back to where we were. Let's re-up." And I think that for some of us today, you've been wrestling with this idea of faith. You've been part of a community and you are still right there on the cusp. You're right there on the edge and you're like, Should I take this step? Will the ground beneath this next step hold me? I want to encourage you that maybe today is the day. Maybe today's the day where you decide that you want to become a follower of Jesus. You want to commit your life. You want to trust that Jesus is enough for you. I want to give you the opportunity to do that. Because we know that in that process, in that process that we are all on, we are all about, we are experiencing life transformation. Transformation that happens from the heart, from the soul, to the mind, and then to our life. We want, for the course of this church, as long as we exist, to always believe that the one is greater than the 99. That we will always be on mission. And if we as a church ever cease to be an agent of change or transformation in our world, then we will simultaneously cease to be able to call ourselves a local church. God, we thank you for this moment today. We thank you that in your grand plan, you have ordained every person to be seated here. You've ordained every person to be a part of this journey. And God, I know that with a room this size, we have people who are walking into this space with burdens on their back that are so big, with worries about their future that are so great, with concerns about relationships that it's hard even to sit through a space like this without thinking about it, without the pain sort of bubbling up in their heart. And Lord, I know that we are, Lord, in a room with people with so many different life experiences, but the one thing that drew us here today was the potential of what you could do in our life if we fully surrendered. If we made this decision to trust every day and every hour and every moment that we would trust that Jesus, you're enough for me. You're enough for me in this season. God, if anyone is in that place right now, Lord, I pray that you would give them the strength and the hope to just walk across that line of faith. And it's a scary step. It's the scariest step you may ever take. Risky. But God, the rewards are so good. Lord, I want to pray that if there's anyone who's considering today whether or not this is a season for them to step back into a rhythm of church and a rhythm of faith that Lord, they were a part of, and maybe it's just now time to get back into that rhythm, that they would make that decision today. And God, we want to pray that as we enter into this next season, as you collectively bring us together as a church, Lord, would you help us to have an impact for your name in a way that we have never had before? Would you help us to serve and love and to sacrifice for this community in a way that you never have before? Would you take us further, God? Take us further than we've ever been before. Would you give us the courage to keep going and to be bold as a community that serves and gives and loves relentlessly in this community, in this neighborhood? God, we thank you for the opportunity that you've provided for us. And all these things, we thank you for an amazing year. And God, we know that the best is yet to come. Thank you, Jesus, for these people. In your name we pray, amen.